email list over there. If you have not gotten your name on the email list, please print clearly so we can understand your email list. Our website is westmassyoung.org, so if you want to look up our future programs or past programs, our archive, you can go to our website. I wanted to thank some people who are helping the Young Association besides my board, which is wonderful. I wanted to thank, thank Dan Hathaway. Thank you very much. He's doing our flyers now to take up into the Hill Country. Thank you, Dan. Dan Hathaway, who's over there. And I want to thank Elric Walker, who's helping us to do setup. And I want to thank Chuck Carey, who's doing our filming and has helped with the web, with the computer stuff. And also, he has a wonderful mythology group. You want to say a few words about your mythology group?
Oh, sure. Yeah, so we meet to discuss once a month. It's
here?
On a Sunday over at Mosaic Cafe. I don't remember the date of the next one. It's either I think it's next Sunday. But if you go to meetup.com and search for mythology in, locally, you can find our calendar there. Or if you want to just, you know, talk to me afterward, I can give you more info then.
And it's on the Grail.
Yeah,
not
the next
this
one is
Sunday.
On the Grail.
Not this Sunday, but the next Sunday. Right.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So we don't take a bathroom break. If you need to go to the bathroom, there's one right here. And please turn off your cell phones. Turn off mine. Please help us with donations. I know some people can't afford $10, but many, many people can. And if we're going to stay at Smith next year, which they've been very generous, but next year it will cost us a lot of money to stay here, which we want to because it's a really good place for us. So we're going to need help. So please contribute at least $10 if you can. And if you can contribute any more, please help us so we can stay here. Okay, we have a flyer for every time we have a flyer for the next time. This is the Age and Beauty, our next lecture. And what really, really helps is we can't get up to the Hill Country. So if you live up in the Hill Country, a hill town, and you can go to a cafe, a co-op, a church, one of the colleges. How many people are from one of the colleges around here? Any people from the colleges? So if there's any place you can put up a flyer for us, that really helps. I'm amazed going to cafes and things in this area, how many people, I chat with them, and how many people have read Jung, love Jung, discovered Jung in high school and college, and they don't know about us. So I'd really love to pull more people in like that. So afterwards, we all go to the Mosaic Cafe on Masonic Street. The Mosaic on Masonic Street. You get that? Mosaic on Masonic Street. And that's where we go and we have a salon. We have tea and we talk more. We get to know each other and we talk about the lecture. So our next lecture is on Age of Beauty. It's by Sarah Jackson, who's been here before. She did Heroines last year. And she did something on art the year before. She's a wonderful lecturer. And it's about how the psyche helps us as we age to feel beauty in a world where beauty is only when people are young. So it's going to be a really good lecture. And then in April, to be announced, and for sure to be announced, Ellen Peck, who has a lot of wealth of knowledge of Jung and art and literature, is going to do our talk on Pity and Terror, the use of theater in the Asclepian dream healing centers in Greece, and the use of theater with the dream work. So that's going to be really wonderful. Right, Helen? Okay. So tonight we have Anita Green as our speaker. She's speaking on psyche and soul, soul and psyche, the same or different. Yes, there.
I need to make one brief announcement. 2 weeks ago, someone named Emily left a message on our home phone, but We couldn't get the number. We couldn't get the last name. It was rather indistinguishable. If Emily is here tonight, come up to us after the talk so we can get clarity.
Any announcements?
About the young?
Well, it's about 3 months.
Well, I'd like to get on to our speaker tonight. Okay. So, maybe you can make a comment and bring that up. Okay, so Anita Green is one of our respected elder analysts.
Very elder.
Very elder. Make no bones about it. And she's lived her material. That's one thing that I love about Jungians, is that if they're truly Jungian, they really live what they learn, because that's the only way we can learn it and work with it and then work, spread it and work with other people, is if we live it. And I've consulted with Anita for about 10, on and off for 10 years, and one of the things that's so beautiful to me about Anita is she doesn't have to prove anything anymore. And she just has this quiet depth that I respect incredibly. So, Anita?
I asked for a microphone tonight because I hope my voice will last. I'm recovering from a very mean bronchitis, and I think my voice has come back enough, but we'll see. So I asked for this microphone. I usually can project my voice, and if anyone can't hear me, can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Okay, thanks. As usual, I picked a topic that's vast. Haven't had the time that I wish I'd had to put it together, but I guess I'll have to trust my soul to lead me tonight. I usually show this picture, whatever talk I do, just to remind us that we are critters. We are animals. Mm-hmm. And it's a marvelous picture. I love it. And one of the most lovely things that was asked or commented on about this picture, maybe I told you already in previous talks, what happens when the little guy, and I think he's a boy, the little guy knows he's not a pug? I had no answer for that. Anyway, what I would like to start with is an article. Let's see if I can. Found in the New York Times, Sunday Times, last June, I believe. But it's called The End of Reflection. And it's by a guy named Teddy Wade. Let me show you a picture he used. Now, which are you in this picture? The one sitting on the bench, or the one rushing around, both either externally or internally? Because he's making a very good point. In this electronic age, we may be in an era of non-reflection. So, he begins, this seems like what seems like a previous era. He says, when I didn't have anything to do, when I was walking around and waiting for a bus, I would sit and ruminate on things. Now I reach into my pocket, pull out my iPhone, and look at my messages and tweet or whatever. I don't tweet. Anyway. And the only place that I'm alone with myself, he says, is in the shower. And that's very, very different from the way it used to be. I remember before there were even any phone messages on the phone, and I'd get in the car and it would be such a relief to be away from everything. It was marvelous. Now, we're never away from anything. And he makes the point that we all get distracted very easily. And maybe now we get distracted more than we ever have. Now that we carry these powerful media devices in our pockets, any time for reflective thinking becomes very minimal. Now, there's a certain research. New scientific studies are showing the extent to which we are becoming dependent on our electronic devices. Not me, but my daughters, because they have to. My grandchildren, all of them. A patient once said to me, "Once I gave my daughter an iPhone, our relationship went downhill." Mm. Now, maybe other reasons why it went downhill, but it was because her head was always into the iPhone and not into some kind of connection with others. Now, participants who had these devices were asked to estimate how many times they picked up the phone, and as they were recording in real time what it was actually was, and they all minimized the time. The average time for some, and I don't know how many, 18 to 33 year olds, was 85 times they picked up the phone during the day. Now, if you have a day of 16 hours, obviously this doesn't include internet use at all. They also underestimated, actually, they said something like 39 times. It was 85 times on the average that they picked up their phones. This means in a 16-hour day, you're picking up your phone 11 times. Let's see, every 11 minutes. Now, they also underestimated the time they spent on the phone once they had answered hello or hi. And it came to be 5 hours, 30% of that 16-hour day. Now, doesn't this, and I ask a question to you, limit or inhibit the amount of time and our capacity for rumination? Just being able to let thinking take us where it wants. And that takes time. It doesn't mean texting. It doesn't mean answering all the phone. That's on the phone. And time spent, and now we want our computers to run really fast, you know, and there's a slowness that goes on. Let me show you another one. I look in the New York for 5 minutes. Isn't this marvelous? They're children with iPhones. And the big sign says, "Slow, distracted children." And I think that's what we're growing up these days. Consider the tweet. I mean, we do consider it daily these days. I understand it only takes 140 characters, so it has to be an immediate, almost instantaneous response. There's no reflective thinking going on here. There's no marinating of thought, because you'd have to use more than 140 characters then to really do that. Let me see. So we spend so much time, and this is what, they may come up with signs like that, I don't know. The New Yorker usually gets, in cartoons, the very first intimation of something that's going on. And I love the cartoons. I can't figure them all out. I love them anyway. This, as you well know, is Rodin's The Thinker. And look how concentrated he is. His head is down, and it takes a blanking out of every other thing around him in order to do his thinking. That is not what I see these days. As a teacher told me recently, She used to come out during recess and they'd all be playing with each other. Now they come out and they're looking at their iPhones and not relating to each other. We are living in a different world, and we will be living in a different world because we tend to accommodate to all of this. And if our computer doesn't run fast, we look around for a technician who can expedite it. And fast, if it's not fast, it's not efficient, you know? And here is a thinker with a sort of his eyes closed, looking at his iPhone. It's not. What was that?
He needs earbuds.
Yes, right. And that's what we're coming to, I think. Now, it seems to me that enlightenment, illumination, takes time. It's slow. And I know if I don't spend some time in the morning leaving myself open to some kind of quiet stillness I'm hoping to get to, the day doesn't go very well for me. It really doesn't. I don't know how many of you have that experience. Yeah, I think so. So I want to, before I move into soul qualities, I want to honor what's been happening in the world today. There seems to be a feminine-related imminent spirit that's bursting forth. I felt it in the D.C. Who ever expected 500,000 people? And not only there, but all over the United States, in the cities, and all over the world, in Tokyo, London, and so forth. It's as though, and if there's any good thing, it's as though perhaps we needed the worst model of masculine.
Narcissism.
Well, narcissism, surely. He's not reflective. Yes. I had no idea that America, the United States, had that much misogyny hiding under the covers. Maybe we needed a model of the masculine. That's not only misogynist, but a bully, and he doesn't reflect at all. I have yet to find that happening in his tweets, for example. If we think of the spirit as an animating principle, particularly in our piece of earth, which is our body, I feel that there's a rise in the level of some kind of feminine spiritual imminence. People felt committed, so committed that they got on buses and flew on airplanes and took trains to be fully embodied and present to what they were committed to. How many here marched in D.C. or marched in some other? Okay. Do you? I wonder if we needed some kind of egregious model in order for that to deepen and to happen. Because what I'm talking about today and tonight, this evening, is that there's a deeper feminine spirit, I think, in whatever I call psyche and soul than there ever used to be. And I was so moved by it. Would anyone like to speak to that? of what they, everyone that I had spoken to who went to one of these marches was deeply moved. Would any who were there like to speak now? Yeah.
You know, I want to say that when I went, I felt like it was just a first step. Mm-hmm. And then the other day I found out about something called SisterGiant2017.com. All day long I've been looking at this conference. Anybody can get this. It talks exactly about the deepening of the feminine.
Mm-hmm.
And it really is the next step.
Yes,
it's really important. SisterGiant2017.com. Read what it says. You won't be sorry. It's amazing. So, and it just, I felt like the march was the first step.
Okay.
But that there were going to have to be hundreds of steps.
Mm-hmm.
And this
mm-hmm.
one is a...
I couldn't agree with you more, yes.
This is a
good step. Yes.
My experience was at a rally in Hartford. There were 10,000 people there on the same day because there were all the sister marches happening, but this wasn't a march, it was a rally on the Capitol steps. And a friend of mine who has a young daughter was nervous about bringing her because she worried about the safety issues, so she didn't go. And I wouldn't have thought of that until she said it, but then when I got there, my entire experience from the time I was there until I left was the most incredible expression of love in every direction. Anytime anyone needed anything, people cleared the way, people lifted people up, people gave people things. I mean, it was like a love fest. That's completely what I thought of it as, and felt it, and everyone around me felt it. It was this massive outpouring of love, like I never thought imaginable to be a part of it. And,
thank you very much. Anyone else? Any males there in this group here? Oh, it was. There were grandmothers and mothers and daughters, every generation represented of all ages, all ethnicities, all different colors. Would you like to say something? Yeah.
Well, there are two things. One is, when I was in D.C., and I was right in the middle. So that means 500,000 people coming from one end and 500,000 people from the other. That's a lot of people. And I felt, for a while, I felt frightened that I could get crushed. But like you said, it was so lovely. There was so much love. People were blowing each other kisses. And there was one moment where a little girl went on stage who was speaking about the fear of losing, of families being, of immigrants being sent back first, families being split up. And so this little girl, I know she must have been 9 years old, you might have seen it on YouTube, but she spoke in English and then in Spanish. And it felt like all the women, this million, half a million women, were just feeling so much love for this, their baby. It's like all of our children. And it was just an amazing experience. They were filled with love. And it was almost like all the women's milk started coming in. It felt like that. There is something, just something really, like I've never felt before, a sea of women.
Thank you. Anyone else before we move on? Go ahead.
I was very moved by the teenage girls. I went to Boston. And by the time I got to march, there were buses and buses of teenage girls who had finished marching and were chanting by the sides of the road to get people as they walked by. And they were feeling their power. They were beautiful. They were so beautiful. It brought tears to my eyes. And they had signs like, "Look out, I vote in 2020. And also, not up for grabs. It was a real acknowledgement of my body is my own. And, when I was a teenager, I had no idea. And these girls were out there chanting it with such beauty and such power.
Thank you. Behind there?
I was in New York, and I was shocked with the number of men and women that were present. It felt like 50-50. And I kept expecting, the streets were narrow, so we were constrained and we were shuffling, and I kept expecting something to happen. But everybody was really, really respectful and really, really gentle with each other. And it felt more than it was just about one. It was about basic decency and respect for life and everyone.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I just kept running into a lot of men that I had never met before, and I felt so moved by them that hasn't been my experience, that so many men have made an effort on our behalf, and I was deeply, deeply moved and felt like I was being healed by it.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
I was in Northampton, and one of the things I felt being part of the group it was very, such a friendly place. And one of the things that I felt was there were so many messages and personal feelings that, wow, we must be a bad people because of the messages that are out in the world right now. But here was this huge group of people, children, men, women, basically showing up to say, no, we're thinking, we're feeling, we're trying to connect, we're trying to hold the line of compassion and feeling for the people around us. And so what you're saying about the feminine principle felt very, very present. Like, our goal is connection, not division.
Yes.
Our goal is to include everyone, and just feeling that in that group, moving carefully. I mean, it wasn't a million people, but it was a bunch.
Yes.
And carefully moving down the street, orderly. It was very encouraging to know that there were that many more people feeling the same thing.
Feeling the same thing, yes. I think there is a new emergence of the feminine.
Thanks, Sarah. I'm used to speaking, projecting my voice, and I'm not sure that's so good for me right now. There is something moving that I can feel that is a new level, a new depth, a new willing to be counted and committed to something. Actually, many people are being activated that have often been passive because they felt everything was going okay. And this is a very different kind of world we live in. So I want you to be aware of this imminent sort of interrelated feminine spirit that's abroad, because I think it really is moving. And let me just... I'll go over a few things here. I get a thing in the mail. It's Christian oriented, because I am a Christian and oriented to that faith. I have respect for all other faiths. And there's a slowness. Let me see. You can read this. Soul comes with the ability to be still. Being still, looking and listening, activates the non-conceptual intelligence within you. Let stillness direct your words and actions. These are quotes from the phrase of silence that I get regularly every month. And that's true. There's a slowness about reflect thinking, introspection. And if you go into analysis, ruminating on a dream, I had the most wonderful experience when we were outside our culture in Zurich for a year and a half. I was in an analysis with a woman who was just perfect for me, and spent a day and a night and the next day at a hotel or a bed and breakfast, and spent all that time ruminating. And I was so fortunate to have that time because I needed it. As I drew dreams, as I drew images, engaging in what unions call active imagination, I hope that we're not moving into an era of non-reflection, but people, more and more people are writing about that. And anyway, so slowness, the spirit by its nature is very slow. No matter how hard you try, you can't cause some enlightenment to happen. And the more you try, the more you fail, obviously. Every religion teaches the need to slow down in order to connect with the self and with others. And there's, of course, in the biblical Psalms, many instances, but be still and know that I am God is one of them. So I invite you all to have some kind of slowness, some kind of slow part of the day, in order to be reflective, and that increases our psychic awareness of ourselves and others. It also engenders soul in one. I had an experience a couple of years ago when I was out for a walk, and I was feeling as gray and as cloudy and as damp as the day. And I did my usual walk, came around by Duna Lane, and all of a sudden, as though it had been planned so that I would notice it, the sun came out and shone on a tree that still had its red dress on. And it was as though it waited for me to turn the corner on my Duna Lane, and then the sun came out as though it was just for me. I felt it was a special moment of grace. And there was nothing fast about it. It just caught me and changed my whole mood about me, about the day, about where I was. And, you know, maybe if we can practice more openness from the heart, you know, grace feels like an accident when it happens. And maybe we can become more accident prone. I hope so, anyway. Now, William Blake, who I believe lived in the 13th century, you must know all about William Blake more than I do, perhaps. But he wrote these things, and you can read the first part. All Bibles and sacred codes have been the causes of the following errors: that man has two real existing principles, a body and a soul; that energy called evil is alone from the body, and that reason called good is alone from the soul; that God will torment man in eternity for following his energies. Now, that was okay with the church at that point. But this was not okay. The following contraries to these are true. Man has no body distinct from his soul, for that called body is a portion of soul discerned by the five senses, the chief inlets of soul at this age. Energy is the only life and is from the body, and reason is the bound or outward circumference of energy. Energy is eternal delight. Now that was heresy. But William Blake was a very smart man. He said the devil said this. And you know, you can't trust the devil. But very often, creatures like the devil or tricksters will speak the truth in our dreams, because it's something that we don't value very highly and something we don't want to hear. So he was very smart. He wasn't burned at the stake. But he believed the second one before the first. Let me see where I want to go next. You know, When I say this arise of the feminine immanent spirit, the relatedness spirit, it doesn't mean that all women are good all the time. That's not so, obviously. But there's a new level in depth of that spirit. And I can feel it in myself. I can feel it in some of the other women who attended these marches. Now, we have been in a patriarchal age for a long, long time. And I think the curve is slowly coming around. By the time of Plato, way back in BC, patriarchal consciousness and mind-body dualism was part of the cultural experience. And the ideal was to be separated out from the body, developing a discriminating rationality, and rise above base impulse, which came from the body. So mind and body really became enemies. And the church fathers, for example, quoted often lines from some of Plato's treatises. And they said, we should make all speed to take flight from the world. One this world to the other, is what they were saying. And become like the divine as much as possible. Descartes was the one who spelled this out the most, but he was only reflecting what was already in the culture. He saw mind and body as distinct entities. He called one res cogitans, that was the mind and the soul, and the good part of one's essence. And he called res extensa to all other things. And he said at one point that he detrusted sensory evidence so completely that he resolved to obliterate whatever came from the senses and declare that information to be false. Cogito ergo sum. That's what we get. Of course he was a thinking type. What else was he going to say? But I, as a woman, who has struggled to come to relate to the somatic core of herself, and views body and psyche as one, you can say, I feel, therefore I am, or I taste, I see, I hear, I touch, therefore I am. Now, it's interesting that in the 20th century this was still around, and it's still around today, but in the 21st century, people like Antonio Damasio, Alan Shore, and many, many others did a 180-degree turn whereby they were studying all the cognitive development in the 20th century. When the 21st century came, they began to see that it was the emotional embodied development that made all the difference. Whether the child was going to be secure and settled and centered in herself or himself. And attachment theory has been trying to make up for that abandonment of the embodied emotional feel of things. And although my Christian heritage has often affirmed the goodness of all creation, and I belong to a church that says, our Father, Mother, who art in heaven. And I've always thought of the Holy Spirit as mostly feminine. And you know, Jung rejoiced when the Catholic Church raised up Mary and all her embodied glory to sit with the Father and the Son. Because he said, finally, The feminine is being recognized. And I think most Catholics now pray to the Virgin Mary because she's so much more available and amenable to prayers than any of the more patriarchal Godheads. So even though my Christian heritage does affirm the goodness of all nature, its theology and behavior have played a key role in the elevation of mind and spirit and the devaluation of body and earth. And the church fathers, you know, argue passionately about whether those provocative and libidinal vessels called women had a soul at all. I guess they came to terms with the fact there that women did have a soul, but it took them quite a while to reach that conclusion. These were all men making the judgment, obviously. And all the emphasis on the ascetic, whatever religion that is in, also separates us and dualizes spirit and body. And the fact that we became an industrial world rather than an agricultural one also exaggerated the split, I think. So, all I can say is enough. I think the new feminine spirit is going to be solving that. It's not that we're going to go back to a completely involved or identified with the earth and its secular nature, but I do believe that the time has come to see spirit and body and earth as of equal value. And in the Old Testament, for example, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, a masculine God. All things came into being then, and without Him, not one thing came into being. No feminine being around at all. And for so long, the Spirit, the masculine God, the sense of mind, rationality, and not letting the body influence one because it was dirty, unclean. And the devaluation of the feminine and earth and whatever soul, underground soul there is. So I think the rise that we saw in all the marches is a coming together on a new level of that feminine spirit. Now, I don't think it's all bad, obviously, that patriarchal consciousness. And I think it needed to develop in a way that it could be released from the matriarchal matrix that it was in, so that the thinking process could go more logically, shall we say, and strike through things with a kind of logos that is creative. And I probably wouldn't be standing here before you, speaking to you, if this hadn't happened. But enough is enough. And I think it's come to a dead end, that dualism between spirit and body. And as I said, maybe we needed, I hate to mention his name, but you know who I mean, who is such an egregious example of the masculine, in order for those with And believe me, men have a great feminine spirit. My husband has a great feminine spirit. And it's as though now we can work together to bring more consciousness. But it's good. That's all that's out of the shadows, I think. Not only just racism and the fact that we don't officially like certain faiths more and not allow them into the country, but as I said before, I was not aware of the misogyny that was in this country, and I think it's out of the darkness now. It's out of the shadow, and I think that there are ways of dealing with that that have never been around before. Okay, let's see. This, I look for a poems rather than psychological treatise or anything from my journals. And this is a wonderful poem. One thing that white women, middle class, and white men have never had to deal with is what Maya Angelou dealt with every day. And I realized that some of our citizens live with fear every day that they will get through it. You know, when a policeman stops me and he sees my age, he kind of laughs and talks to me and gives me a warning. He doesn't even give me a ticket. I have no idea what it would be like to be hauled out of the car and made to stand just for a license violation or something of that sort. This is a wonderful poem. And I ask all the men and women here to see if it reveals and supports what I'm saying about the rise of the feminine spirit. Here, root yourselves beside me. That's me. I, Angela, know what I'm talking about, in other words. I am that tree planted by the river, which will not be moved. I, the rock, I, the river, I, the tree. I am yours. Your passages have been paid. And all women have paid a lot of passages. They don't need to do any more. Lift up your faces. You have a piercing need for this bright morning dawning for you. History, despite its wrenching pain, cannot be unlived, but if faced with courage, need not be lived again. Lift up your eyes. Upon this day breaking for you, give birth again to the dream. Maybe she was thinking of the dream of Martin Luther King. I don't know. But when I realize how people with dark faces face something that we whites in the middle class have never had to face before, it moves me deeply. Okay, this is a wonderful time I had with my grandson, Rowan, when he was about 3 or 4 months old. And I show you this picture because I believe it is close to how soul is engendered when we're older. I think I would be a Winnicottian if I wasn't a Jungian. And he's the one that really knew and said, you know, there's no baby without a mother. Now, this was completely unexpected. I was sitting holding him, as you can see. And we started looking in each other's eyes. Every one of the 5 senses was satisfied. The touch, the holding, the firmness with which I was holding him. I was singing lullabies to him, and he was kind of cooing in response. he was listening and I was listening. And as I say, touch was satisfied and every one of the senses, five senses, seemed to be very satisfied. And then all of a sudden, our eyes locked into each other. And it felt like we were in another place with each other. A soul place. I can't explain in any other way. It lasted for quite a while. It was very satisfying to both of us. Now, Winnicott says that there's no baby without a mother. Fortunately, he said, you don't have to be perfect. You can be a good enough mother. But he also said that it's the other of the mother that makes the child know that he or she is a human being. Because through play, through talking, through speaking, the other is passed back and forth between the mother and the child until there's an indwelling in the child of a sense of their own being. This is what's happening in the picture. And I believe it's what happens when we have soul making happening within us. Now, my name of my talk is Psyche and Soul. But psyche has become so psychologized that it doesn't contain that sense of a different dimension of world that soul does. And if you look in all of the textbooks, the psychological clinical textbooks, and the psychiatry ones, there's no mention whatever of soul or the possibility of that happening to one in a way with the other and experience of the other. In the index to the collected works, you will see five separate pages devoted to soul by Jung. And I think it's because he believed that there was a religious instinct in the body as powerful as thirst, hunger, and sexual longing. Maybe in a post-Christian, post-biblical age, it comes later than at first, in when we're middle-aged and facing death, perhaps. But he believed it so fully, and he found it because he believed it and made a space for it in his work. He found it in most every patient he worked with. I forgot to bring a whole bunch of books that came out of the house so fast to get here. But Jim Hillman has tried to make up for the loss of soul. And he's a provocateur, and I miss him. He's no longer on this planet. But he would challenge all of us who were into the developmental model of finding out what of traumas happen in childhood and then working with those. He thought, come on, your business is to find what the calling of is of this person. And then lead him or encourage him to be that person. A lot of people in our country change careers in mid-age. We have a pastor who was a journalist for all her life and then went to theological school and became a pastor because she could no longer resist the calling of her soul. Now, in his three books on soul, Suicide and the Soul and the Code, the Soul's Code and his one on character, he tries to get back to that place that he feels is a gift at birth, and in the biblical time, and I'm just speaking now of a post-Christian and biblical time, it was so important. obviously people will have louder callings than others, and he gives some examples in one of his books. Did you know that Yehudi Menuhin knew at age 4 that if he didn't play the violin, he wasn't going to be who he was meant to be? I didn't, but he was taken to a concert, and when he saw the concertmaster stand up and play the violin, he looked at his mother and said, "Can I have a violin for Christmas?" So, of course, because he was a child, 4 years old, they got him a little play toy with metal strings. And he bashed it on the floor and he said, "No, no, no." Even at 4, although he could not get his arms around an adult violin, he knew what his life was going to be. And I didn't realize that... let me see here. Ella Fitzgerald, for example, went to amateur night at the Harlem Opera House once when she was a skinny 16-year-old. And it came time, it was a talent show, you know, where we have them on TV now. And when it came time for her, the maestro announced her, and there was something going on. She wasn't very comfortable with what. And she was going to dance. And the maestro went over and said, "No, no, Ella Fitzgerald has changed her mind. She's going to sing for us." And that started her career of singing. She knew somewhere that her calling was to be a singer, and she couldn't dance at that time. And I didn't know, I had no idea that, Gilda Meir, Golda Meir, pronounced wrong, who was head of Israel during the 1973 war. At 11, she was growing up in Milwaukee schools. I didn't know she was educated in the States. And she protested against some of the expensive books that were being bought when the poorer children, her classmates, couldn't afford them and couldn't be part of the class. She rented a hall, she raised money, she spoke, and when her mother said, she was 11 years old in fourth grade, that maybe she better write out her speech. She said, "No, I'm just going to speak for my head." I didn't know that Golda Meir was a prime minister way back at 11. She had a very strong calling. And Jim Hillman does is to try to say this is more important than any work you do in the developmental. To find what it is, because there's a unique gift at birth, and it's as though a guardian angel, I think the Greeks call it a genius, or a daimon, those were the Romans of too, a daimon. As though there was some energy or some spirit that was going to grab you, and you were the only one who could do what was in store for you. Obviously, some people have a stronger calling than others, but he tried to bring that back. I don't think he was probably very successful, but let me see. First, I think I have Jung, I don't know where that image is. Let me see if I can find it. Oh, let me show this, because it was a very important part of both the Hebrew and Christian faith. The fact that only you could hear the call, and it was unique to you, and it was part of your soul. And he says, there is one thing in this world that you must never forget to do. If you forget everything else about this, there's nothing to worry about. But if you remember everything else and forget this, then you will have done nothing in your life. It is as if a king sent you to some country to do a task, and you perform 100 other services, but not the one he sent you to do. Human beings come into this world to do a particular work. That work is the purpose, and each is specific to the person. Remember the deep root of your being, the presence of your Lord. Give your life to the one who already owns your breath and your moments. I mean, this was a very real feeling for such a long time in the biblical world. We've completely lost that, I think. Yes.
Didn't Jung have such a feeling that
Well, Jung himself knew that he was going to have to go very deeply into his own psyche and the psyche of others. So the only thing for him to work toward was medical degree and psychiatrists, who weren't very well valued at that time. And he did. Yes, he did. He had a sense of what his life was going to be, and he lived it fully. Any other remarks or... Yes, go ahead.
I have loved to play the piano since I've been a child, and I've been feeling very, very cold. And I feel it even more so. I was just over at the pizza place, and I just went at it and just started playing, so I was like... And somebody said they really loved it. I said, thank you. I said, this is my calling from God. And when I lost my mother in high school, I really got into that calling with the music and sacrificed just about everything to just go through to do that. It's not an easy thing.
No, it's not easy to follow at all.
Because we live in a society, and we were just listening to this on the Giant Sister Giant, where people were talking about a society where people base success strictly on me, myself, and I, and money. And the thing is, I have a joke about it. I've been a romantic composer who wound up Baroque. Because I followed my calling. It's just totally my calling, and I just had to share that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes.
You know, I'd like to address your point for a moment about the relationship between Fala and Call.
Yes.
You know, they play off each other.
Yes, they do.
Trauma both blocks and motivates.
Mm-hmm.
In part, the trauma is always the thwarting of who you really are in an early family context.
Mm-hmm.
A child who isn't held the way you hold your grandson.
Yes.
And unfortunately, too many young people experience that. And they're traumatized in their authenticity to be who they really are. And so looking developmentally at those experiences can be helpful to understand them more deeply and to work through.
Yes.
But you know, there's a lot of people for whom that repression becomes a motivator.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to say, I am going to show them I will be authentically who I am. And Carl Jung could be Exhibit A to certain people.
Yes.
And a guy who's got a quarterback, the Patriots, in the Super Bowl last Sunday, is Exhibit B. Because Brady has felt that way himself, and he's been determined to be the best at his position. And if he's not, he's close to it.
Mm-hmm.
So he's channeled that energy. So there's a dialectic between trauma and calling. That I think gets to a higher level, and I think that's what Jung would, you know, be willing to consider himself.
Oh, yes, I think so, too. He, you know, there's a story about a patient who came with to him, a woman who very much needed help, but he was only going to have one time to see her. And she came in, and he started to try to get to what it was. And all of a sudden, he heard his mother singing lullabies to him. And so he started to sing lullabies to this patient. I don't know if you remember that story or not. But it was just the right thing to do. And she could open up, and part of her could be healed.
Mm.
There.
My sense is that Martin Luther King is an example of someone who found his calling,
yes,
and helped to heal the nation.
Thank you. Anyone else have anything that they want to contribute right now?
I wanted to ask you if you felt the calling.
That's an interesting question, Betty. It certainly didn't manifest itself until middle age, because I did as one did back then. I was in college in the late 40s, graduated in 51, and you went to college, and that's where I met Thayer. And I did, you know, I was pinned in my junior year, I was engaged my senior year, I was married the same month I graduated, and I started having kids without even thinking about it. That's just where women were then. So it wasn't until middle age when I went to Thayer and said, you know, Thayer, I'm going to be the worst bitch in the world if I don't find a way, a calling. and I did. Yes.
I'm just realizing right now that what I was saying about Sister Giant 2017, what I saw all day today, what moved me and touched me is every speaker found their calling.
Mm-hmm.
And so they really are able to move me and move the nation.
Yes.
It was like listening to Martin Luther King over and over from so many different perspectives.
Yes.
And so I thought I'd share that.
Thank you. But I did find my calling. But it wasn't until middle age. And that happens all the time. Not only did I had to do it for myself. And I think whatever you have to do for yourself is a gift of motivation for working with others too. Now, it's interesting because we objectify the body so much in this present age. We have images of what it ought to be, you know? And we diet it, we exercise it. Even dancers and athletes at times are not subjectively relating to their body cells. They learn all the techniques, but they're not in their bodies so much when they do it. Actually, we can tell a good dancer from a great dancer because it's not just learning all the techniques, it's living it so that it comes through the motions of the body and affects our body as we're watching. So there's a way that so many of us are not living subjectively inside of ourselves. And I had to learn how to do that. I would like to come to, let me see, what's next? Okay. Jung, and I showed you that sense of the oneness, but the otherness of the child, as Rowan and myself. This is what Jung has to say. The underlying idea of the psyche proves it to be half bodily, half spiritual substance, capable of uniting the opposites, is never complete in the individual unless related to another individual. Now, you understand, Jung was an introvert, and when some of his first members were being in the carriage all by himself, looking out at the natural world. And he didn't have a very good experience in his family, and he thought, you get away from family as fast as you can. So this is an unusual thing that he says. But he very much experienced this in his work and in relationship to others. This is what he says. The unrelated being lacks wholeness, for he can achieve wholeness only through the soul, and the soul cannot exist without its other side, which is always found in a you out there. Not an inner. He knew lots about the inner you, but a you out there. Wholeness is a combination of I and you, and these show themselves to be parts of a transcendent unity. Now, as a mother and grandmother, I do believe this is a more fleshly, holding, hugging, and looking I in you. And that happens early on. Because our body is our first home, and Freud was right that the first ego is a body ego. And from the body, we learn a lot, a great deal. And it affects us for the rest of our lives. So I would like, let's see how this works, to turn to my sense of what soul is. Yes, go ahead.
Is there a source for that quote? A source?
There is. I don't have it just available right now. Yes, there is, certainly. maybe I can, I don't know whether I can find it easily here, but anyway.
I have a different opinion about this
okay.
statement. And I think that what we're lacking is unself-consciousness. I remember growing up and being unself-conscious, being part of everything. And then I went to school. And I remember being reading, and first we could just read, and I was happy. Then we went to the step of reading and having to answer questions about it. And I remember reading the questions after going through all this story, unself-consciously being a part of it. And then when I had to answer a question like, what color was the dress she was wearing, I became angry and frustrated because, to me, that wasn't important. And now I had to become conscious, go back in the story and look over these several pages to find the answer to a question that to me was not important.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that was what school does to us.
Okay.
As primitive people, I would say we existed in the community as a whole, following what our parents were doing, listening, being a part of it, being loved, sharing. And then we got to the civilizations that were empires, and we became slaves. We became objectified, objects to use for something by somebody else. And I think that's where we went wrong, in accumulation, in greed, in taking more and valuing people less. In our education, even to this day, we have to learn to fit in and play a role in the whole system so we can make somebody some money if it's not ourselves making it. And this is where I think the problems come in, is losing the sense of community that we had when we could trust and be taken care of.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Did everyone hear that?
Okay.
What I want to do is at this point to move on to what now, what I said is that psych has become so psychologized that it doesn't contain anything that amounts to soul anymore. As I say, Jim Hillman tried to bring that back with a sense of valuing the calling of each individual that only our unique individual can do. If it's not done, it won't happen in this world. But I have a certain experience of soul, and it comes from an other, but I'm not sure what that other is, but let's call it spirit. And as it has intercourse with my fleshly bodily nature, I can feel soul being made inside myself. So I think Jung is right that the psyche, which was still called soul at that point, when he was around, is half bodily and half spiritual, And I wonder if we have bodies in order for soul to have a place to settle into. I mean, if we were just spirits hovering around, I don't think we'd be talking about soul. I think soul comes through intercourse with our fleshly embodied natures. And everyone here may have a different sense of that other, which is the what one can call the sacred dimension of life, or another dimension other than the TikTok time that we do every day. Okay. So with I don't want to get, there are many, many different ways of describing soul, and I don't want to get into a lot of those theories. But for me, soul happens when it comes into my fleshly embodied sense. Now, what I would like to do is to give you a sense of my own experience with soul. I've had many. And learning in the scientific myth that this is not scientific doesn't stop people from having experiences that seem to be related to another dimension of life. Doesn't stop us at all. Anyway, this happened in my first Jungian analysis. When I was in my 30s, and we had taken a semester off. Thayer was pastor of the First Congregational Church at that point. And because all the faculty members had the semester off, we asked if we could not, too. And so we went to New York, and this was my first experience of Jungian psychoanalysis. And I remember coming to him, and after working with him for about 2 months, I came in with a dream that I had found a key to unlock the closet door where a 4-year-old girl was entrapped. Now, the dream, I'm sure that I had the key in my hand because this particular man became the father I never had. He was able to relate to my little girlness and be there for me in a way that I found profoundly healing, although I didn't use that word then. So he was the one who allowed me to find the key to unlock that door. Now, the dream didn't come up until toward the end of the session. And it brought tears to my eyes. And that was pretty unusual, because I didn't cry easily. And soon our session was over. And I got up to leave. And he took my hands in his. And he just held them for a moment. And that touch really started something coming up in me. And I went out quickly because I didn't want to cry in his presence. I mean, I've learned a lot since then. And ran down the stairs, and I knew I couldn't just get on the subway and go home. We were in New York City. And Central Park was right nearby, so I walked over there. And I sat on a bench, and all of a sudden I was weeping, and powerfully weeping. Now, I didn't cry. I mean, I got sad, but tears didn't come to my eyes. And then I discovered later on that when you try not to cry and hide your tears in the pillow because you can't trust that mother to be tender with feelings, your tear ducts get hard, and you really can cry. So this was an amazing experience for me, to weep with just all the fullness of my body. And I sat on that bench, and I could feel something other happening. I mean, I didn't plan this, but I was aware of memories from that four-year-old child, and how at that point I had pledged myself not to let my mother ever know me, and that I certainly wouldn't let her know any of my tender feelings. And I stopped crying, or I hid it in the pillow. And therefore my tear ducts got very hardened. So all of this release was an incredible experience, as you can imagine, when you don't weep with the whole body. And that's what I was doing. And then remembering how this four-year-old girl got locked in the closet because she wasn't allowed to be in the family fully, and what I really was as a human being. And I engaged with her. I remember sitting there. It was springtime, so it was that beautiful yellow-green. And bulbs were coming up, and leaves were bursting out on the trees. And it was as though it wasn't so much a feminine nature, but it was all of earth. And I began to feel a oneness with nature that I had never felt before. And I came all together. I mean, I could feel my inner body from the soles of my feet to the top of my head. And the weeping was very releasing. And I sat there for a long, long time, knowing that something was occurring that I needed to pay attention to. And then a voice, it sounded like a voice from outside, but it could have been from inside, I don't know, said, "You've forgotten, Anita, how touch is important to you for knowing yourself." And I came into myself fully then. It was an experience that changed my whole life, because I knew that I had to get in touch with what I call my split-off body complex. You know, in yearbooks, they put one name by yours. They come up with something that they think is the essence of you. And mine was floaty. I really wasn't in my body. I wasn't thinking of myself as floating around. But I think I was, because I wasn't fully there. I became fully present to myself and to another. I couldn't describe the other, except that it was the whole natural world and that wonderful color of spring and the bright bulbs and the leaves on the tree. And I just sat there and absorbed that. I knew I had been given a soul kind of experience. I didn't know what soul was really at that point, but I knew it was something that I not only needed to take seriously, I wanted to take seriously. And so my whole mission about myself changed. I never felt so put together as sitting on that bench, and came all into myself. Maybe since I was a small child, a baby perhaps. And this kind of experience I allowed, and I felt it as a gift. And what I knew was that no sitting and talking about dreams and the body was going to do it. I had to start living out something. And I started to go to Charlotte Selver. Maybe some of you are old enough to remember her. She's the grandmama of all sensory groups. And she started a group in New York. And I went regularly. And she would do things like getting us to fully lie down on the floor. You know, come on. I mean, a lot of those were pretty boring. And to come to full sitting and to stand. And one day she said, "Do you allow the earth to support you. She said, this building goes down to a solid concrete block and well into the earth. And I said, well, any idiot knows that the earth supports one. And then my body spoke. I heard a clear body from my pelvis that said, oh, no, you don't, Anita. And then I looked at how I was standing. And I was standing back on my heels. And in order to stand back on your heels, you have to tighten up your knees and your butt in order to maintain that posture. And I realized, no, it's too scary to trust the world. You don't at all. And I remember Martha Graham speaking of the body as being the house of pelvic truth. And I think she knew, because she was a dancer who was in her body, and you could tell that, yes. So, again, my body spoke the truth to me. Any idiot knows the earth supports you. No, that was not going to be allowed to be anymore. And so I continued that with massage, with some kind of body work, and then I went into training with a woman named Alana Rubenfeld. And the interesting thing was that this was in Jungian when I was in training. And when, after I would have a body session with Alana, sometimes the only way my schedule could handle it, I would then go up to my analyst on Central Park West or whatever, actually this was when I was in training, so it was in New York, Ed Edinger. An 80-degree turn. I mean, he knew nothing about body. He was shorter than I was, and the only thing he did was shake hands at the beginning and shake hands at the left, as I left. And I swear, he would reach out like this, even though he was shorter than I was, and reach my hand. And finally, I got the courage to speak with him. I said, by then, everyone was calling him Ed. He was Dr. Edinger before that. And I said, you know, I am not really going along with this handshake stuff. And we've got to find a way to greet each other that's more equal. I was amazed at myself for saying this. And we came up with high fives. So every time I came, he would high five, and every time I left, he would high five. He was great. He was really willing to do that. And so I was able, because Jungian psychoanalysts, like Freudian ones, you know, you don't touch anybody. That introduces a very alien element into the work. Psyche and body, for so many psychoanalysts, has been dualistic. And this was not my path. So I had experience after experience of that sort until I began to feel comfortable inside myself. And it gave me a sense of being who I was meant to be, you know? It gave me a centeredness, a groundedness that I had never experienced before. So that particular soul experience was incredibly powerful. Now, I'm sure that you've all had, or many of you have had similar ones. As I say, the scientific myth doesn't prevent any of us from having these experiences. And I work with that. It's interesting. As a Jungian analyst, I am well aware of the interpersonal stuff that's going on, the intrapersonal, and sometimes an analyst can get into a dream of a person, for example, and just go with it. And pretty soon, they're not even relating to the person who's sitting in front of them. Some unions, anyway. And in the vision seminars, let's see, I don't think I have that. Jung took off on Christiana Morgan some of her dreams.
And he used it for himself to get lost in the, kind of get lost in the symbolic mysteries, going from one to the other, until finally the actual person of Christiana Morgan was no longer there, around. And then he realized, I think, what he was doing. And he wrote in the second volume of the Vision Seminars, I think as much to himself as to other Jungian analysts, okay, if you dream about something and you study about something, don't think that you've got it, because you weren't there in the body when it happened. You just weren't there when it happened. So that a felt body experience is very, very important to anyone who's going through therapeutic work, because that's the way we sense what's really going on inside. Now, he also said that you can't look at the, well, let's say, a negative mother complex. You can't look at that as something you can read up on. You know, you can study which goddess is more amenable for your psyche than others. But the fact is, and long before he used the archetypal core of a complex, he used the affective core. He says everything is affectivity. And that is the bridge between body and psyche. So he really felt that, and he often, I mean, he was a big man. He looked like a farmer going out of the field at night, but he turned around and he would look like an erudite professor. There's a wonderful story about a restaurant in Bollingen where he, in his late 40s, started to build a kind of rough tower, and then he planned and all the other parts of the building, his retreat. And he banned, can you imagine, he banned the telephone, which was the only way of communicating with the outside world. He cooked over an open fire, and he read by oil lamps. Now, can you imagine us going to some kind of retreat place and not taking our computer with us? Or our iPhone? Oh, come on, that's ridiculous. But he, in his own time, knew that he needed that space to really ruminate on himself. And he did a lot of thinking there, and he wrote an awful lot of the collected works there. Yes.
I'm wondering if you could elaborate or explain what you meant by, or what you meant by affective core and
affects. I mean emotional stuff.
That
the core of a conflict is always emotional in content. And until that emotion has been neutralized, you will do the same things over and over again, even if you know all about your negative mother conflicts, for example. And neutralizing that is quite a task.
Which is different from an archetype.
Yes.
Which is what?
He came to an archetypal core, but he always said that an archetype can't be taken as a concept. Unless it has an electrical charge with it, it won't make any difference in our lives. So that for him, the archetype, which was at the center of a complex theory, like a negative mother complex, was both some image and some emotion. Quite a bit of emotion, actually. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. There.
One of the things that therapists working with PTSD, whether it be childhood trauma or war trauma, is that the dynamism of the PTSD will keep repeating itself until someone is led back to the original experience and has the experience of the affect, the incredible emotional power of that experience. And I had that personally, as I think I've shared here, 32 years after my combat experience in the war. I was led back to the most terrifying experience I had in combat, and went through that in a group, and finally was released from that PTSD. So what Jung is saying is part of what is now being discovered in working with early trauma or other types of trauma.
Yes. Thank you, sir. I want to show you some pictures of Jung. This is a poem by Martha Graham, which I don't think I will read, but she knew the body from the inside, and you could tell that in the way she danced and thought. Okay. I want to read this, though. I meant to bring the book that has meant a great deal to me, by Robin Van Lovensels, who happens to be... Robin Van Lovensels wrote A Dream in the World, in which she dealt with a patient of her own who had similar embodied experiences that the early saints had. She also looked up and worked with Hadovich, a woman who did not become a saint, but was very much into a mystical way of life in the 13th century, and how their experiences happened to be very similar. As a matter of fact, Santa Teresa, Hadovich, and many, many other women, including men, wrote about their encounters with the spirit in very erotic sexual terms, as though they were actually having intercourse with the god. And that is true all the way through. See, both Mary and Hadovich, we see how religious experiences boldly claims the body, how central the soul is in this claim. In my years of Jungian training, the early therapeutic experience, I felt I gained a fairly deep understanding of the psyche. But even then, I missed acknowledgement of the central importance of the body in the therapeutic work. I have come to conclude that while the psyche may house a great deal more than my interpersonalist colleagues may give it credit for, it does not house the body. And the soul lives in the body, even if it speaks through the psyche. The importance of the body for the life of the soul has become central to my understanding, and to my understanding also. Most of our body disciplines are for ego needs, as we often treat the body objectively and we don't live inside it. Do you know Mary Oliver's work? She really is a marvelous poet. And let me see, I think I have it here. You do not have to be good. Do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You have only to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. And this is a call for heart rather than head, I think. But head is never left out, I don't think. Now, this is an old, old book. And the earth has a soul. Jung called it the Anima Mundi. And back then, and I think earth is becoming to have a soul again, Jung felt that, and you can see, this is outside Bloomington. and I'll come back to it. But it's an old book, Jung on the Natural World. And I don't know whether it's still in print or not. Is it? Okay. It was back when nature was once fully spirit and matter. You believe that the loss of emotional participation in nature has resulted in a sense of cosmic and social isolation. It is not the airy Christian soul that we have lost, but more concrete, the bush soul, that links us with the totem or ancestral spirit in nature. You can read the rest, I think. There are given qualities of the world that can only be partially understood and thus tend to be represented by numinous symbols. Nature is not matter only, she is also spirit. Spirit seems to be inside of things, the soul of objects. Now, maybe they argued about women back then, now they're arguing about animals. I don't know about you, but all my labs had souls, I'm sure. And an animal that affects you deeply and comes over to comfort you does seem to have a soul. Now, here he is, cutting wood. What if consciousness has no roots in the earth? This is several years before Jung actually died, I believe, when he still did all the work at Bollingen. Nature and psyche and life appear to me like divinity unfolded. What more could I ask for? I believe this is the time he takes to write a letter. One wrote letters then. And he tried to answer everything that came to him. He loved his pipe, too, whether it was lit or not. And that's the Zurich Lake behind him. I am fully committed to the idea that human existence should be rooted in the earth. And there he is, sitting on a wall near Bollingen, his retreat center. My subjective view of the world, however, is not a product of rational thinking. This man was a great thinker. He was also very intuitive and went right to the spot in one that needed work on. It is rather a vision such as will come to one who undertakes deliberately, you have to intend to do it, with half-closed eyes, and somewhat closed ears, to see and hear the form and voice of being. I think Jung let himself not be such a rational thinker. I mean, when he sits you don't know where he begins and nature leads off. He is so one with the natural world. I think this is about a year before he died. And the earth has a soul. And I think that's where the feminine is leading back, not to identify with earth as it once did unconsciously, but more unconsciously looking at earth. Not that we're lords of earth, but we're part of nature. And we need to be responsible for what we're doing to earth. You remember when he had that interview with the British commentator. And he was asked, I think, do you believe in God? And he said, he ruminated for a moment, and he said, I don't believe, I know. And knowing in the Hebraic sense of the word, as Adam knew Eve, he knew. And this was a man with a great soul. And so I leave you all with that image, and I will leave it up in case there are some embodied kinds of things you would like to say or what. Whatever. Yes.
I know I've said this recently, I've decided to say it a lot more, but I like what he said about no matter what the scientific myth says, you know, the human experience of soul and other experiences. And I again feel, and it's why I became on the board of the Jungians, because it was a place where you could talk about these things.
Mm-hmm.
And I almost feel, as a community, we haven't really broke through yet. I haven't. We come and we hear you speak. I know, I come and I hear you speak, and I'm like, thrilled. You know, I'm just like, ah, speaking my language. You know, or I'll read Jung's memoir, and I go, oh, I can have a dialogue with Jung. But I'm not sure as a community yet. It's a wish of mine somehow that there be more communication about these things. Am I making sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think people come to some of the things just because they can be talked about here.
Yes. But there's something yet feels it needs to emerge.
Okay.
As you were saying, yeah. The feminine is emerging.
Okay. Go ahead.
Just in response to what you just said, I would say, you know, you could always start dancing or singing. You know, that no amount of talking would be a place to do those things.
No matter, what was the last sentence?
Said no amount of talking will replace the actual.
No matter of talking will replace the actual
experience.
Okay. Yeah.
In one of the earlier quotes that you showed, it said that the psyche needs an other to fully exist and that the soul does as well. But the difference between psyche and soul, is it a mind-body difference? Do you think that's the main difference between psyche and soul, that psyche is more grounded in the mind or thoughts and soul?
Well, it certainly has been. And as I say now, psyche has lost all reference to soul at all in the clinical world. And sometimes when people will bring in an experience, they've had an experience with another analyst of being rejected and looking behind it to see why they're coming in with this miraculous stuff or whatever it is, a fairy tale or something. I'm sorry, I'm not sure I answered that completely. But
can I follow up on that? I'm wondering, this might be too simple a question for a very complicated answer, but what is soul, what is psyche, and what's the difference?
Well, psyche, Patuke, was Greek for butterfly, I believe, which is a wonderful image for psyche.
Which is a wonderful image for psyche, Patuke, Greek. Psyche always meant soul, meant that part of the person that experiences another dimension to life other than our tick-tock everyday time. Getting up in the morning, having breakfast, going to work, coming home, having dinner, going to bed.
That's soul.
That is psyche.
That's psyche.
But it used to have an element of soul in it, which it does not any longer.
because it's been psychologized. I learned about a lot about psyche when I went to the Jung Institute. And because I was a Jungian, I also learned myths and fairy tales and different religions and how they related to people. But there was one of my teachers who insisted upon putting them together, Christopher Whitmon. And he would always want to know how we related the personal, if it was appropriate, to some larger ball field of the archetypal unit and universal experience, when it was, it needed to be very appropriate. And he was the one that really insisted upon that. Wouldn't you agree there? Yeah. And it was very, very helpful to know that you just don't count on a dream, when, as some Jungian analysts do, and then to take off on that. I think I'm getting away from your question, actually. Soul has a metaphysical, it's closely related to religious thought. And that Jung saw as a separate instinct. He found in the people he worked with a religious instinct, which he thought was as powerful as sexual longing. When Freud and Jung were together, and there were 25 years between them, so it was a perfect father-son that didn't work out. And he said to Jung, we must always stand by the bulwark of that sexual ideology. And Jung, of course, had to split off because he didn't believe that. He felt in the body and as a gift at birth, practically, that there was a religious instinct. And now, Jung was accused of being too spiritual. And he tried, very often, he talked about the imago Dei, the image of God in the larger self, inside of us. But he had a very hard time, except when he was interviewed in old age by this British reporter, saying that he knew in a way that expressed a very deep sense that there was another substance or energy outside of the everyday. He tried not to do that because he wanted to be as scientific as some of the others were in his profession. I don't think
that
answers.
That helps. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah,
there.
As I've been listening to you, Anita, I've been reflecting on my own journey as a Jungian analyst. And Jungian analysts, particularly earlier on, were called analytical psychologists.
They were called alienists, too.
Yes, no, that's psychiatrists.
Oh, that's psychiatrists.
No, analytical psychologists. In my old age, I think I, and frankly you, have become analytical soulologists.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah. One question. Is a soul a phenomenological experience? Is that how you know? Is it an experience that is specific? Is
when I had that experience in Central Park, when I became one with nature, and yet it was happening to me, so there was something other going on than my own intention.
See, that's what I would call the unself-conscious. When you can actually become unself-conscious, and that's to me who the greatest dancers are. They're not aware of, I have to look this way or do this or act this way. They just feel it and do it without being conscious of themselves.
No.
Because
I think one can come to, with a good analysis or a good therapeutic session or sessions, that together again,
Now, it's a different kind. What Jung said, that what he was doing was contra naturam, in the sense that one had to become aware of a lot of stuff from the unconscious, that one, that was why one goes into analysis, in order to enlarge the sense of self. Now, when one becomes quite conscious, and I think I'll tell a story about Jung here. As I said, there was a restaurant in Bollingen, and the owner of the restaurant said, sometimes a very nice farmer from down the road comes up and he sits around and he talks with people. And that very nice farmer, Jung, came up several times and he sat with people and he was so natural. He spoke with them about food and wine, and then when they heard he was one of the famous psychologists in the world, they were amazed, because Jung himself became that integrated and unselfconscious again. So I think there's a way to be that way when you've done all the conscious work. And I don't think that is anything that can't happen to you, really, too.
Right, and I think sometimes getting rid of our labels of ourselves,
yeah,
and our and who we are because we've accomplished this and we've become,
yeah,
this, and that's what he did. He dropped all that.
Mm-hmm.
He just became one of the people, one of the society,
exactly,
doing,
exactly,
good.
One with nature.
Which,
yeah,
is how we grew up, but then we had this culture thrown,
yeah,
on us,
yeah,
which makes us psychologically disordered. Really, when you buy,
yeah,
into,
but one can
thing,
go back to that, but it's different. It's more conscious, but it is still just very respectful of life in general and people in general. Yeah.
Just one comment. I want to thank you for your presentation. I was very moved and touched by almost everything you said. I was paying attention closely. I just thought of a comment. I was reading a book by on Wittgenstein and religion, the famous Viennese philosopher, and he had a view. He said, "I am not a religious person, but I look at every problem religiously."
Mm-hmm.
It just reminds me of you.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we need to stop.
Okay.
So you can